inviting me to speak here. It is work done with Felix Ladisky and Graham Smith, both at JLA. Both photos are their officially shared photos. So I try not to embarrass anyone by taking a photo that they would not want to be shown. So I assume that's the right one to use. So I'm particularly happy to give the talk here because Graham and I, on and off, we have been thinking about this problem for like 7, 8, 9 years. We get somewhere recently, so it's something good to celebrate. Let me confess up front that the material and the reason why things actually work is slightly technical. The problem is a conceptual one, but the solution is somewhat technical, so there is a very dry aspect of the talk. I'll try to minimize that aspect of the talk, but it's also one occasion I can give a little proofs and go a little more detail into the result itself, so looking forward to the discussion. So because of the worry how dry it will be in the middle of it, let me just give you the punchline. The capacity is a mess. It's fun, it's difficult, and it's a mess. But we find that in the no-noise regime, that was resisting any analysis for 20-some years. Everything is tame and normal, up to a reasonable approximation in the noise parameter. So everything with less and less noise, it become tame and normal again. That's the take-home message. Now, the outline. So I need to see how much I have to talk about channel, quantum channel and capacity to this audience. I have to find out the amount of background to put in. And then I'll start to talk about the fun part, that what we don't know about the quantum capacity. That's the part that I think even some of the people working in quantum information may find a little surprisingly complex. So I will make sure that I spend enough time discussing those. Then I'll talk about what we know. That is a slightly more fun part because we actually know something still. And in particular, I'll talk quite a bit about the notion of approximate degradability that allow us to obtain the result. And then I hope I have about 20 minutes to discuss the result. That's the plan. So before I describe the quantum setting, we all know what communication of data is like. You have some communication channel from some sender Alice to some receiver Bob. You want the message you want to send to be sent as correctly as possible, despite that no channel in real life is completely noiseless, so there is always some noise. If you don't control the noise, there's very little you can do about the problem. In the least, someone can cut your channel. They dig the road and then your internet link is actually broken, then you can't really talk anymore. So there's always some assumption that we put in. That's typically the one we use is the discrete memoryless channel, which means that the input for the for one use of the channel, say the last one here, the output can only depend on the input. And so we also assume that the channel is available for some number of uses, say n. It's the same quantum and classically. What I said here hold largely in the classical setting as well. Then we can consider taking up the message that we want. One thing I want to say is that I usually use a cursor on the screen as a pointer.
We have a hockey stick.
Ah, good. So good. These are good. I can't use a laser pointer either. My hands shake so much. So we can take the message that we want to transmit, first encode it, which takes the message into the end inputs for your end users of the channel, and then the channel send it to this end outputs that the receiver Bob will take, and then he will decode, and then you hope that the final piece here is similar to the input piece. In a quantum setting, once you throw the input into the channel, you lose it already. So there's no way you can compare the input and the output in terms of whether it's correct or not. The usual technique is to include a reference to the input, which for all purposes is the purification for the input density matrix. And then you compare this joint state with that joint state. And if for all input phi, the output state, which is usually a mixed state, is close to the input state, then you say that you have done the communication right. In other words, for those who know what it is, we are looking at this whole block here, the encoder, the channel, and the decoder as a unit. And we wanted to simulate the identity channel in the diamond knob. And then if we can do that for n bigger and bigger, and then we send in a message bigger and bigger, yet pushing the error to be smaller and smaller, if it vanishes with n, then we can talk about the asymptotic number of qubits that we can transmit for n, and then divide by n. That's the communication rate when you have n users. Take the limit when n goes to infinity. Take the supremum, they're actually the same. Then that is your optimal, the ultimate limit that you can send data across. We call it capacity. Any question on the notion of it?
What do you mean by number of qubits?
Number of qubits is the, for say n use, you have to first fix n, and then you look at the dimension of the state that you are transmitting. You take the log of that, that gives you the number of qubits that you can send through the unit.
Okay.
And then you optimize over the encoder and the decoder for each n. Then you have the optimal rate here. Then you take the soup over n. Nice. That gives you the capacity.
Maintaining some kind of fidelity or some kind of closeness.
The optimization also have another piece that I was hiding. That the encoder and the decoder are subject to the fact that the fidelity is at least 1 minus, say, epsilon n or something. When epsilon n is a vanishing sequence of n.
Okay.
Yeah. It is just too ugly to write out. But roughly speaking, it's the asymptotic number of qubits you can send noiselessly as n goes to a large number.
What do you mean by fidelity? Is it for each state or just...
The whole thing. The whole thing. Now, this is essentially good that you guys asked. We're asking a lot. We want an increasingly big, for n users, we will be sending a message which is exponential in n, in dimension. We want the entire thing to come out closer and closer to the input as n goes to infinity. We're not saying that one segment of the state should come out correctly. We're saying that the whole state should come out correctly, and the state get bigger and bigger. You may wonder why we are so greedy. Because we are used to be able to do it classically. That's how the classical definition is as well, that we can get the block size to be bigger and bigger, the entire piece will become more and more likely to come out. And we have the capacity expression, we know how to achieve it. So we're asking the same in the quantum setting. Now, given this discussion, clearly it is a very large and operational definition of what is a capacity. We should not expect an expression that involves only one use of the channel. Classically, I should write it down on the board. Chucks. When you have a classical channel, the capacity C of the channel N is the max over input distribution. So you have a channel N, there's an X, output is a Y. So you have a probability distribution of Y given X. So you maximize over the distribution over the input alphabets, which already tells you what Y will distribute it like. X and Y are generally correlated. You calculate the mutual information between the two variables, X and Y. You do the maximization. That's your capacity. This is really crazy if you think about it. It's a one-use expression. It has no reason to be there, except it is there. The way we know that this is right is because we know how to achieve this rate. And independently, we know that there is an upper bound, which is also the same expression. The two proofs are totally different, and they happen to give you the same expression. Now, also this expression, if you take two of the channels together, you make two copies of it, X prime, Y prime. You optimize over two uses. It's additive. It's two times the best quantity for one use. So in the quantum setting, things are not so, there's some similarity, but there are some deviation from that nice picture. So before I show you the equivalent quantum capacity theorem, I need to define a few concepts here. The I always label A as the input, E as the environment, B as the output. There's always a reference to the input. When we have N users, we still have one reference because it's a single message that we want to send. But we'll have N input and N outputs and N environments. The transformation from A to B, so UN is what we call the stand-spring dilation for the channel or the isometric extension, because every channel can be represented as an isometry from the input system A to two systems, B and E. That step itself is isometric. You can reverse it. The step that cannot be reversed is the tracing of the system B, that you lose system B. Therefore, when you only look at, you lose system E. And when you look at only system B, you see the missing system E as noise in your system, in your output. So we call that end of row. The transformation from the row in A to end of row is a transformation of any input density matrix to an output density matrix that describes your state change. That is completely positive, trace preserving, and linear. And everything that can happen in quantum evolution of this form, unless you have memory, unless the memory comes back to haunt you. Likewise, the transformation from A to E is another channel, because we trace out B in this case. We call it the complementary channel for N. Given a channel, the complementary channel is defined up to a unitary on E, and vice versa. I mean, a unitary on B is also irrelevant in this talk. I mean, we can revert it. So this is the setup we're having. And I often think about the output as a pure state on R, B, and E. And then when I need to talk about capacity, then I look at the right system and only analyze that output. So now the capacity theorem was proved by Lloyd, Shor, and Davidek. The first thing, the hard thing to show, is that you can achieve this rate of a quantity that looks tremendously like the classical setting. So once again, we have the quantum, in this case is quantum, mutual information between R and B. R is the input here. The reference, remember what is the input for your for the comparison. So we're looking at the mutual information between R and the output B. Except this is the quantum mutual information. So the entropies here are no longer the Shannon entropy. These are the Voinomian entropy, which means that it's the entropy on the eigenvalue of the reduced state to the system that you label there. So we reduce the R, calculate the eigenvalue, and then we calculate the entropy. In this case, we reduce the state to BR and do the same thing and calculate what this quantum mutual information is. This part is very much like the classical setting. In fact, if you block these two things out, it is a different capacity called the entanglement-assisted capacity of the channel. But in the quantum setting, when you want to send quantum data and you don't have free entanglement, it turns out that the analog of the expression has an extra term which you have to subtract, which is the mutual information between R and E on the same input state. Roughly speaking, if your input correlates with the environment, it is clearly a source of noise to your output. And you have to do something to correct for it. You have to remove that correlation with the environment. And that's where you have to spend rate to deal with. Now, one other way to see why this expression makes sense is to consider a noiseless classical channel. It is a special case of a quantum channel. What it does is that for a particular basis, if you put in the ith message, it gives it's an isometry from I in A to I in B and I in E. It's an isometry. Okay. And if you trace out the environment, then you both still have the message I if you put in I. But you can't have any superposition between different values of I. You do the calculation. This mutual information is the same as that mutual information, and the quantum capacity is zero, as it should be, because it's a classical channel. And this is a generalization for any channel. It is a rate that is achievable. Any question on this expression? It's called the coherent information. The coherent, because we subtract the correlation with the environment. The normalization, too, has to be there. Just have to take it.
Maybe it's worth mentioning that that's equal to H of B minus H of E.
Yes. Right. We will see that later as well. The reason I would usually don't show that is because it looks like it's the entropy of B minus the entropy of E.
What is that? It's equal to that.
That is half of the mutual information, the difference between the mutual information. The entropy is usually not the same as information. That's the reason why I kind of get obsessed about writing the mutual information form. Yeah, but it is the S of B minus F of S of E as well, and we need that expression later. Yeah. So it's shown to be achievable with serious effort. And also, just like the argument that we mentioned, we can take N users and call it a new channel, M. And now we can write down at least this much can be achieved. It's an achievable rate as well, because I take N of these channel together, and then I call for that big channel now. But deep down, that big channel has N users of the small channel. So if I want to count the achievable rate for the small channel in that strategy, I have to divide by N, because I put N of the small channel into the big channel. And this rate is clearly achievable. And this quantity is always at least as big as N times that.
Which rate is achievable?
Hmm?
Which rate is achievable?
This rate is an achievable rate for the channel N itself, because I can always put N of the channels together. Yeah. And the second quantity is an upper bound shown by Schumacher and Westmoreland. So we have the equivalence of the Shannon noisy channel coding theorem, that this is the capacity for a quantum channel, except we have a soup over this parameter N. It has nothing to do with the block size anymore. It just seep into your optimization problem and is there. And furthermore, we know that we cannot get rid of it, as we'll see right away.
There is no longer any. I was trying to ask dependence on the state,
Does dependence on the state disappear because you already do the max?
Yeah.
That optimization, by the way, I want to mention that is this little piece here, the optimal thing, determines how you're going to do the code. It is a way how you actually define the code space. It appears in the definition. Many users of that, you take the typical space there, and then you take a random code of a certain size there, give you the correct code space. That will achieve the rate. But yes, it is nothing. It's not your message. It's just a mathematical object that happened to be in your expression in the end. I hope I didn't say anything wrong. John was staring at me. have an expert of the capacity here. So now, here comes the fun part, I'll say. Everyone will say that this is the fun part. The truth is that this expression is actually super additive. It's known to be super additive. And so we are stuck with the soup in general. In fact, it's not just super additive. It can jump from zero to non-zero. So we don't really know if the capacity is zero for a given channel. And you don't need to find a very difficult channel to exhibit this effect. The channel that was used to show this 20 years ago was the depolarizing channel. Now, there are two ways to talk about the depolarizing channel in the qubit case. The first representation is that with probability 1 minus p, you send the state untouched. With probability p over 3, you apply a sigma x to it. The x, y, and z are the Pauli matrices, sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. Okay, so with probability p over 3 each, you do x, y, or z. You mix up all the four cases, and you send it through the channel. You can rewrite it slightly to a different parameter, eta. I shouldn't use eta because I use eta for something else later, but it's a different error parameter called 4p over 3, which is that it is a probability that you throw away your input and send off garbage, I over 2. It's the maximum mix state that you do not need the input to send off. And so in this form, it is the quantum generalization of the binary symmetric channel that you either send a bit across or you send a random bit. So there are two representations here.
So two means that if I have 5 qubits, I can send the information.
Yeah.
Oh, basically, like a 5 qubit code.
I can say a little more. Next slide. I meant to put the information on the board. But yes, they show that for certain error parameter, you have no one-shot coherent information. But when you put some number of channels together, you optimize over the input, you suddenly see positive number. And so let me say the consequence is that we do not know the capacity between these two numbers. We still do not know. Even after this talk, we still do not know. We know it a little better than we used to. We do not know when the capacity is zero between these two error parameter. We still don't know. P bigger than 0.25, you have a no cloning bound. That will say that the capacity must be zero. Lower than this, we know how to code. In between, we don't really know, which is really insane.
So in the general case, you said there's no algorithm known. Does that mean people don't know it, or it's actually uncomputable?
People do not know.
Okay.
Yeah, there will be one more slide on that as well.
Okay.
We know more than we don't know, but we do not know that we cannot do it. It's so true. So now, page down. So this is the reason why suddenly it become positive. I'll just draw a little diagram on the board. What those three authors did was to find out that you take your qubit, you encode it into 5, and this encoder takes 0 into, I think, 5 zeros, and 1 into 5 ones. And what happened after 5 of these channels, and say, let me take 0.192. You decode. The whole unit here is a new channel on one qubit. There is a decoded, there is a probability that you get it right. There's a probability that you get an overall encoded X error. There's a probability that you get an encoded Z error and so on. You look at that distribution of 4 possibilities. The entropy of these 4 items is less than 1. And so you can just then use a random code on this whole unit. And you can send things at the rate. So the rate is at least 1 minus the entropy on the PI, PX, PY, and PZ. So this is actually wrong. So these are the probability of identity X, Y, and Z. Now, for the depressing channel, they're equal. Here, they become different because of the encoder and the decoder and the 5 uses. And how it works is also very intriguing, because it turns out that the probability, the signal Z on the on the 5 qubits individually, all act identically on the code space.
This encoding looks very... So, Pauli Z seems to be the worst sort of error or noise. So why X and Y and Z appear symmetrically here?
In the original channel, they are the same. You have the same probability of X, Y, and Z, about 6.7%. After the encoding and the decoding, these three are no longer necessarily the same. Because your code treats X error and Z errors differently. When it sees X errors, you can correct up to 2 of them. Z errors are bad, because when you have any single Z error on 1 out of the 5 qubits, you get a logical Z error. The funny thing is that you don't need to discriminate where it is. They always act the same. So you have higher logical Z error than X error after the decoding. But the strange thing is that this quantity becomes heavily suppressed compared to 5 uses of the channel, because your environment cannot gain entropy or cannot gain information out of putting a sigma Z on 1 out of the 5 qubits. It is very, very strange.
Do they really apply a decoder? I thought that they just put in the density matrix and then they can coherent information and it's positive.
They use a 5-bit code.
But they don't use a decoder, do they?
They did. I mean, the one way to think about it is to decode and then look at the entropy of the output and then see that it is strictly smaller than one. So you can then treat this as a new Pauli channel and you know how to code. That's one very simple way to think about it. Of course, the decoding does not increase your visual information, so you don't need to put the decoder in. But it's easier to think about a two-dimensional output.
But that's how they calculate that it's a...
That's how they actually do the calculation.
That's how they calculate in that paper, I
see. Yeah. And the same with the later work by Graham and John as well.
This is before we knew how to prove the hashing of a phone. We didn't have the LSD theorem.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
That's right. And clearly, this is not a classical effect, because in the classical setting, you don't even have that negative term in your expression. Here, the idea is that there's this negative term that causes problem, and it's a negative term that we're trying to suppress with the degenerate code. So any question on this result? Why we know that this is not additive? It's a fun result. Then, that's back to Jamie's question. This is how much we do not know. You give me R, then I can find a channel that depends on R, such that R copies of it has no one-shot coherent information, but then the capacity of that thing is actually positive. So some larger than R number of copies, when I tensor together, calculate the coherent information, it will be positive.
Those six people prove that they don't know this?
Those people prove that statement number three. But what they do not prove is that the determining whether the capacity is zero or not is undecidable. We believe that it is not decidable, but we do not prove. We have not yet been able to get the proof that it is not decidable. It needs a proof to prove that you need a proof to show that it is undecidable, and we don't have that. And we do not think that it is decidable, but we don't have a proof. Yeah. This does not achieve it because n depends on r.
I don't know how to parse your number one there. I think that looks like a typo.
Huh?
Number one, is that a typo? Greater than r? You need to write there.
Oh, shoot. There's no comma there.
Okay.
I thought I was missing the comma. I put the comma back on every single slide last night. Thank you. So let's not look at that anymore and move on to number four. Of course, you heard of the super activation result by Graham and John Yard here, that you can have two channels, none of them has any capacity, however the number of users you have, and then you put them together. Even the one shot coherent information is big. It's 0.02, right? For the example that you have, the small example. Yeah, and you can push the result. You can have two channels, one have no capacity, one have capacity no bigger than two. The input dimension to N1 and N2 are both, I think, D. Then you can have something that is like half log D. Constants are all the same. If you see a half, it can be a third in this talk. If you see a two, it can be a four. For simplicity, all constants are the same. Likewise, another very strange thing, I won't have a lot of time to talk about private capacity in this talk, is that it's the capacity that you can send classical data that is private from any eavesdropper. For all purposes, remember that everything that does not go to the receiver is with the environment. So it is classical messages that the environment collectively has no information on. You can define what it is and so on and so forth, and it was known about 14 years ago that the quantum capacity can be strictly smaller than the private capacity. Which is also exciting because we think to send something privately, you probably have to send quantum data anyways. But no, you can actually send a little more private data than quantum data for some channels. It means that you don't necessarily need to keep full coherence. There's some noise you can actually leak to the environment, which will not hurt your private data. And we have full, they have full characterization, what these are. And then you can push again. That you can have channel that has very little quantum capacity, but a lot of private capacity. So it looks like a mess, but we also know a little bit of something. So Now, let me introduce this class of China called degradable. It sounds pretty silly why we want to define anything like this, but just bear with me for a moment. It is a class of channel that you can take another channel M, compose these two together, and that gives you the complementary channel M, NC. If you want to draw everything in the isometric extension picture, you take the output and put it through another unit tree. And then there are two pieces, E prime and F. E prime has the same dimension as E. You should think about E prime as the output for this channel M, and this is the environment for the channel M. And if you have for any input here, E and E prime are invariant under swap, you call this channel N degradable. So it's like the Bob want to be Eve. Why does he even want to do it? So we have the channel N that takes A to B, and we write it as a isometric extension to B and E. Then the definition that is that N is called degradable if you can find a different channel M, which takes the output B, send it to E prime, such that the combined action A to B to E prime is the same channel as from A to E.
So Bob can simulate the environment.
I see. Yeah. One example is that, the erasure channel that with some probability, I send you the message. With some probability, I tell you that there's an error because I have given it to the environment. Say if I give you the state with 90% probability, I give the environment 10% of the time. But both you and the environment know who has the state. Then I can take your 90% output and further apply a different erasure channel on it so that in the end, only 10% of the time you get the input. Yeah. It's a very strange concept, but it gives us a very nice result that for this channel, the capacity is the one-shot coherent information. It magically is additive. And we'll see what is the magic if I have enough time to prove it. Yeah. You look surprised.
No, I'm confused.
Why?
No, I'm not familiar with these concepts. So.
After seeing how super additive it can be, why, if you have this property, it will not be? The depolarizing channel is not degradable. That's what I would say upfront. The erasure channel is degradable, so we know the capacity.
How special is degradable? How special is it? Is it common?
It is not common.
Okay.
It is not very common at all.
It's not common. So if someone is running a real experiment, then mm-hmm. it's close to degradable or it's far away from degradable?
If they have a very low noise channel, at the end of the talk, we will see that they are very close to being degradable. This is what we find. Yeah, the question is how close a channel is to being degradable. And so we now see why this is here. Now, given this kind of result, if you are me and Graham, I clicked the wrong button. This is the kind of result you want to obtain to get further. So you want to show that capacities are continuous, which was not known before 2009. That if you have two channels, they have a distance in diamond norm, no bigger than epsilon, then the capacity is no more different than 8 times some vanishing function of epsilon. And that's not known before. Here, if you fix the output dimension B, this is the dominant term. This is the binary entropy function and is the x log x for x being small, which is a problematic term. I will say upfront that the important thing to have proved is things like this, that you have n users of the channel acting on part of a state. You change that channel to something else close to it in one use, but not in n users, of course. Then the difference between these two output states in the entropy is linear in n with a vanishing function of epsilon. It's unexpected because naively it is an n squared here, and that ruined all the result, but it's actually n. So if you plug it back in, you get bounds like this, that if you have a channel, you have one that is degradable near it, then you can approximate the channel capacity by the one-shot coherent information of the degradable one nearby, and then with some term vanishing with epsilon. But this is not a good idea. The worst part is because we don't know how to find this M that is close by and also degradable at the same time. We actually try to use this result to do some estimate of the channel that we're interested in, and we find it really hard to find these things around. We prove it for the private and classical capacity as well, and it's really hard to find nearby useful channels. This quantity is vanishing with epsilon, but it is having infinite slope. It's not a very good feature also. For low noise channel,
You have M and you can find M which is degradable, then this is true.
Yes.
But hard to minimize epsilon which is because...
This is the problem, yeah.
Why is it difficult?
It is not convex optimization. Which, if you talk to any optimizers, like Jamie here, they will smile at you and they will certainly know that you will not get anywhere.
Is it just because it's diamond norms, it's very difficult to compute?
The diamond norms okay.
Yeah, that one is some definite programming.
Yeah. I guess the degradable parts are hard part, right?
Right. Yeah. It is a strange optimization that people do not understand very well. And furthermore, I will see for the low noise channel, this is trivial because a natural degradable channel nearby is an identical channel, and the upper bound is reaching maximum plus an error term. And that is stupid to even consider. Push down. So the nice twist come 2014. I saw the talk in July 2015 by Sutter. I should say everyone, Sutter Schultz, Winter and Rayner. So what they do, instead of trying to find a degradable channel near yours, they said that, well, let's not even bother. Let's degrade your channel. But if you can't get the complementary channel, so be it. So previously, we want to take M, compose with M to get the complementary channel. Now, we don't even bother getting the complementary channel. You try to get close. And call that approximate degradability. So it means that, say, if epsilon is zero, if eta is zero, then we get back the original definition of degradability, right? But now, if it is not zero, so be it. You let go. You say that, well, we know that it is not the same. Let's write it down how far we are and proceed from here. I think that's a bold move, and it's not known to be equivalent to the other notion of approximation. Then it turns out that the proof that this equation holds extends nicely. And they get a theorem, a continuity theorem like this, that your capacity for the channel that is eta degradable is never further away from the one-shot coherent information. It's always at least as big as that, but you can never be bigger than that quantity by minus eta log eta, plus some small term that we don't care.
Is this convex now?
Hmm? Ha ha ha, yes.
Okay.
That's exactly why it's important. Let's see, push down, always press the wrong button. First, it is an SDP. It doesn't look like it, but it is. So you can numerically find eta, and you can also numerically find M. We'll see why it is useful later. Even for analytic work, having numerics is tremendously useful. The remaining problem is just that this is still quite a bad function of eta because it does not have a finite slope. So this bound does not vanish. I mean, we don't really, so you can, I will show you the slide with this bound, what upper bound of the capacity you can get for the depressing channel. We don't really know where the slope is in the curve. And do I have time to say some proofs? I think it's actually more satisfying to explain why suddenly things work after telling you how many things doesn't work. So this is the thing that we need to optimize by choosing the correct input. We want to do this for many users, but let's look at the expression for one use. As John alluded to, we can write it, this is super additive, I don't need to say that anymore. We can first write it as SB minus SE, just expanding every term and doing the subtraction, then B is the same as E prime F for any M that you append after the channel N. So B is just E prime F, unitarily related. They have the same entropy. The magic comes here that you add S E prime and subtract it and separate into two terms. The first term is a conditional entropy, and that is actually subadditive. In fact, this thing here, if you can just eyeball it, is S out. It is SB minus SRB, and it is minus of, it's a negative conditional entropy. And so that is not, it is known to be at least additive. And so when you revert the sign of that kind of conditional quantity, you get the subadditive quantity up front, and then you're down to this difference, SE pi minus SC. Now, if your channel happened to be eta degradable, then E prime and E has suffered through different channels, but the channels are no more than eta different from one another. So these two things are also very similar to something on the order of a binary entropy function of eta. Again, the constants don't really matter in this talk. Now this works for one use. Just summarizing the result up there. And now if you apply it to N users, you once again write it down, only one reference. You have this big conditional entropy thing up front, just applying this top line to N users of the channel. Then we have this difference here that we have to control. Now this difference is exactly the kind of thing that we already know how to control from the continuity argument. Remember that we have N users of the channel. Let me scroll up there, page up a while. This kind of thing, we know how to bound the difference. The reason why we know how to bound it, it's not us. We know how to bound it, but the technical tool we use come from Fairness and Liskey. Fairness inequality gives you an N square here, and Liskey brought the conditional version in so that the dimension that appear in your upper bound of the difference depends only on this, the conditional entropy that is the system in the front and then the system you condition on. So it only depends on the dimension of the front system. And that's why we knock off the factor of N. So we actually know how to deal with these things already. So that is not a big problem for us. So we know that this is order N times eta log eta. In the newer result, they have better conditional entropy bounds by Andreas Winter, which improve over the Fairness-Liskey inequality. And so they have tighter constants. This one is subadditive. So we can just look at each of them. And each of them is no bigger than the one-shot coherent information with a correction term. And that comes from two slides ago, that this object and the max of this object is off by this term. So I can throw this all in. And each of these is just linear. The difference is linear in N, and both error terms are on the order eta log eta. That's how we got it. And the actual constant is one.
Why did you have h of eta over 2 and not
Let's bring this offline. Constants are all the same in this talk. Yeah. There's a reason. I think I wrote it down without making it up. but yes, because the talk is long enough, so I don't want to bring the constant into the problem. So we get this bound that they proved. Now, the first thing you should ask is then, what does it give for the depolarizing channel? And that's the question I asked David, when he gave the talk at Banff. And a few months later, he gave me a plot that they replaced the archive version, and they showed me the plot. So the red dotted line is a new bound. It's very, very close to the green line, which is the one-shot coherent information. It's a beautiful result. I asked him for the data. He sent me the data. I think there are about 100 data points covering this range. So I look at this part, and I cannot tell whether it is sublinear or not, because I don't have enough data points there. Yeah, the first point here and the next point when I draw the line between them, it's already different from the one-shot coherent information. And I was a bit too embarrassed to ask again. So I was sitting on the problem. In fact, Darius was offered the project. He did something else, but later on I found that Felix has a code for that kind of calculation, and so he gave the very convincing data early this year that it is clearly quadratic. And that's why you have such close bound to the data. Now this is where the numerics is tremendously useful. If you don't know that it's quadratic, we're not going to spend a few weeks trying to analytically get a proof. But now we know that the result is there. We wanted to understand why. So what is the degrading map for each P that will give you that good a imitation of the complementary channel? For some of you who didn't see it on Friday, you have a moment to wonder what it is. So this is the theorem. The degrading map we use is the complementary channel of a depoising channel, but with slightly more noise. And this is how far we can degrade it. It's p squared here with some constant. That constant is correct. Felix worked really hard to get that. one thing I should mention off the slide is that the diamond norm distance of the channel NP with relative to identity is 2p. So p is effectively the epsilon that I've been talking about throughout, but it's off by a factor of 2. Because I suddenly switched from the diamond norm distance from the identity to the error probability here, but it is roughly the same parameter. So how do we... once you see the result, it's actually not so hard to understand it. Let me show you the consequence of the capacity first. We take that eta, plug it into the upper bound, and we got the capacity. The one-shot coherent information of the depoising channel is also known. It is just 1 minus the binary entropy function for P and minus P log 3. It's known. For the general Pauli channel, it's not known analytically. It's another crazy thing. And then we get this term that we do not know how to control. So that's how much we still do not know about the capacity. So we do not totally resolve it, but we know how much we do not know. And it's sublinear in P, which is quite surprising.
Where does this combination come from? Is it just you come up with it? Or?
Yeah. Well, the thing is this. Why we figured it out? Because we know that we finally see a chance that we can solve this problem. After so many years, we try so many things. We try to show that, well, if you want to do block codes like this, you lose your rate by a factor of 5, by a factor of 2. You seem to totally ruin the rate in the low noise regime. But no, we also have this low density parity check matrix codes, and there's so many long block length code that we do not know how to use any operation argument. So the moment you see the numerics, the only thing you have in mind is that I get to prove this. I must be able to find a good degrading map. And so what we did initially was to look at the numerics to see what is the numerically optimal solution. It didn't look very clear what it was. But then there's a guess. Let me show you the guess. You want an M that makes this small, right? And this is close to identity. The first try is to take M equals to the complementary channel of NP itself. Right? Because this is close to identity. So if you write it as an identity and choose this to be equal to that side, then you get 0. So it's not a bad guess. And it has the right form. I mean, the zeros are in the right place as numerically. It looks about right. It gives us 1.5, not the square. The 1.5 is already very good because if you plug this back in, you already get the sublinear term here. So that's already a result that we can use. Of course, we try to push further. The way to push further is to say that this is not the identity. This is actually a little noisier than the identity map. I lose some of the information. Using the argument about the erasure code, what I should do is to put a little more information from B to E prime to compensate for the fact that from A to B, I lose something. And that's how we come up with that functional form. we add A P squared to the noise and see what A works. And the quantity is, you can look at the theorem, right? A is just eight over three. You write down the equation, you explicitly write down what is the difference. It's actually not so hard, it's just a 4x4 matrix. It was even nicer because John Watchers and I have studied the channel quite heavily 2 years ago. So we know a lot about the complementary channel of the depolarizing channel. So we just took the last page of that paper, write down the equation quickly, and check that if you can choose a single A, that makes everything relevant, quadratic in P, in that difference. And it just pop out. There's only one parameter you need to set, and everything will come out to be quadratic. We don't know why. We still don't know why philosophically it should be the case. Maybe we're lucky.
Is there any indication that that's the optimal map to pick? Like, have you done any optimizations and see if that pops out? Or?
Wow. I should have paid you for that question. Yes, we do. Felix has the... Remember, we started with the numeric. So we actually know numerically the whole behavior, except it's not analytic. So you can compare. I don't want to screw with the computer here. I have his slide on my computer too. The two curves are very close, but they're not equal. So there is something you can do slightly better. Maybe it's high all the time in P. Maybe it's like P to the power 2.5 or something like that.
Do you think it's still a depolarizing channel? Or did he, or a complement of the depolarizing channel? His code kind of...
I need to ask him. I think it is... I think very likely it's a depolarizing channel. Because if you think about the geometry and the symmetry of the problem, you seem to ruin the symmetry between E and E prime by choosing anything but the depolarizing channel. But I should double check with him. Yeah. So that gives us the result we want for years and years. Generalized to the generalized poly channel, despite the fact that there are three error parameters now to emulate in the complementary channel, we have three parameters to play with. Instead of 1a, p squared, we have a1, a2, and a3. And you can always choose them so that you get everything to quadratic. And the detailed bounds are in the paper. It works with high dimension generalized poly channel. I'll have very little time to talk about the private capacity.
If you have higher dimension poly channels, what's
the same quadratic behavior happen that say if the distance to the identity map is P, then you can have a degradability parameter. We call this eta the degradability parameter. It is all the P squared. Then all the capacity bound will be...
What's the dependence on the dimension of the system?
Ah, good question. It does grow with the dimension. I think it is a B squared, size B squared. Yeah. It is a constant to the problem, to us. That's why we never think about it, yeah. Right. Now, I didn't get a chance to tell you much about the private capacity. It's another one of these fun problems that is not additive. You can do something fancier to get more for some setting. You can sometimes get a lot more. But the same kind of argument, not the same argument, it's not a black box argument that we have here. You can use very similar ideas, very similar argument to get similar bound. Sutter they already did all the bounds in the paper. We took that and we repeated the same game and we get similar bounds. So not only we know the private capacity, we also know that the quantum and private capacity are also differing from one another by no more than order eta log eta term. The leading term is again the one-shot coherent information for private capacity, which is something again we did not know upfront until this work. Because we don't know how to control eta previously. But for low noise channel, it is small. So it means that everything is the way we think about it. Now, let me get back to that 1.5. The initial guess for the depolarizing channel. It is generally true. Since I don't have a lot of time, I have prepared to give the proof, but I'll not do it. You can show that. If you have a channel that is epsilon closed identity map, then you can degrade it up to 2 times. Step 2 is correct. Epsilon to the power 1.5. It's a simple exercise that you can easily sneak it under John Watcher's class, and the student will prove it. Oh, it's not hard. Once you know what, you have to prove it. So watch out for those. He might consider that a nice little problem in homework. So you can simulate get bounds. We do not know whether 1.5 is optimal or not. It is. We try quite a bit. We try on and off, but the 1.5 come from, let me tell you where they come from, after all. So one, the epsilon, one order of epsilon come from the fact that these two channels are off by epsilon. Another half epsilon order come from the fact that if this is true, then the complementary channel of N and the complementary channel of the identity has diamond norm distance epsilon square root with a constant in the front. They happen to multiply.
Why is that?
It is a nice result about 10 years ago that despite the fact that there are some ambiguity in the isometric extension, there exists one. So if you have two channels that are close to one another, you can find two isometric extensions that are close to one another. These are unitary matrices, right? So you can define the distance by, say, the maximum eigenvalues of the difference. And then you can deduce them back to the complementary channel. What will be the diamond norm distance? It's a very useful result. And it's dimensionally independent. Magic, yeah. It's a great result. We still don't know. The proof techniques, kind of like say, if you want to keep it as a homework exercise, we get 1.5. I have my grad student here, so you know what you can work on in principle. What we can't do, we let you do it. We do the easy part, that's the guideline. So to summarize, what we get then out of these not so difficult work, but you have to know what you need to prove. We show that for general cases, power 1.5 is sublinear, and in some interesting channel that we know the structure a little bit, then it's quadratic. The private and the quantum capacity are similar to the same order. Now, what the consequences are for those who actually need to go to the lab and do things is that, say, if you want to find a capacity approaching code, you can actually just use the random code in the LSD theorem. You don't need to worry about optimizing over degenerate subspaces of some type. It is really nice because many things we want to prove without knowing what is the optimal code space looking like, we can't even start any proof. So we hope that some more result can come from that observation. For those who work on quantum key distribution, the private capacity of a channel is the same as the key capacity of the channel. And you know that already using classical error correction and privacy amplification, you can approach the one-shot coherent information, which you know up to order p squared is already the key capacity. So you may as well not bother doing anything fancy. Is that all? Yes. So thanks for your attention.
Do you think this gives any hint of how you might attack more noisy depolarizing channels?
We do not know. I think we wish we do.
Oh,
we wish you work on it. We were. That's actually where this comes from. We were actually working on the noisy regime. And in fact, because we couldn't get enough insight into the depolarizing channel itself, we're looking at other simple qubit channels. Bay has this nice result that for a lot of qubit channels, whether they are unital or not, one use have no, at the boundary where the one-shot coherent information just turned to zero, when you take them in small blocks, she and her student find a lot of these degenerate codes that will push the capacity to be above zero. The effects are always small, as you can expect, but it's actually quite a generic property that you can do it. So the additivity is non-generic. We know that already. But then how big you can push it, we don't know. And for example, the big question that we want to know, where is the threshold for which the capacity has turned to zero?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
And where we're embarrassingly, we barely push on the one side.
Yeah. Yeah, it is crazy for 6%.
Our biggest embarrassment.
Yes. Yes, but unfortunately, the technique is very tied to the fact that the noise is so low, and we're looking at just the leading order effects.
Any other question? If not, let's take the baby again.